You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 317.
On today's show, we talk about ancient footprints in Germany, one of the world's oldest streets in Turkey, and Neanderthals in Naxos.
Let's dig a little deeper into footprints older than my favorite hiking boots and streets that have seen more history than our RV's odometer.
What the?
So no. We had AI write that bit. I said, do it in this funny, jokey style using something from the articles.
Oh my God.
And that's
so
what
dumb.
It came up with.
That's
I love
so
it.
Dumb.
I like it.
That's so dumb.
The RV's odometer.
No.
It's on point.
Mm-mm. I'm not. No.
Welcome to the Archaeology Show.
What's that?
Yeah, exactly.
What is it?
Welcome to all our new listeners who are our current subscribers.
Welcome to people who subscribed to us a month ago and then heard nothing.
I do appreciate the several of you that emailed in and said, you guys still alive?
Did you get in an accident? Like, what happened? Yeah. What's going on?
Yeah.
No, we're still alive. We just got really, really busy in the last month.
Yeah.
And didn't honestly prioritize the show, which was a mistake, but we're back and we're doing it.
Yeah. I mean, we're both responsible for getting all the other shows out on the APN. Mm-hmm. And that's been kind of a lot lately, just keeping that going. So,
yeah.
And then Rachel had some out of town time for about 3 weeks.
I did. I was visiting family and then I had some work stuff. And gosh, when you're out of town, it just makes it really hard to find the time to get the recording done. So,
yeah. So
anyway, I'm back. We're here. So I don't remember where we were the last time we recorded, but we were probably like in Washington or something.
Probably. Yeah, I think we were.
Yeah. Well, now we're in Mexico.
Now we're in Mexico. Yes. Which actually makes it a little bit easier to record down here because we're not traveling every weekend.
Right.
Which tends to cause problems.
It does.
We have several weekends of travel coming up, which is unfortunate, but.
Yeah. We do. We've been here for 2 weeks, though, and so we're trying to use this opportunity to get, you know, a little bit of recording ahead done so that when we travel, we'll be okay, so we won't have a big old break again, but, you know, no guarantees.
Yes.
Anyway.
I'm going to promote something right now, too, in case you haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. If you follow our newsletter, it's in there, and you can join the newsletter by going to archpodnet.com and just scrolling a bit, and then it'll prompt you to join the newsletter if you want to toss in your email address. Comes out every Friday, give or take. We used to have a podcast called Archaeo Gaming. It actually didn't last very long. Mm-hmm. The host just, for whatever reason, couldn't keep it going. But it was about not only like archaeology and history-themed video games and what they get right, what they get wrong,
mm-hmm.
but a little bit about the just archaeology and history in gaming in general, even if it's mm-hmm. not completely focused on that.
Yeah.
Like I learned by listening to that show that the popular game Assassin's Creed actually takes place in historical settings, which I never played the game. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's relatively cool. Historically accurate for what you see and things like mm-hmm. that. So anyway, Ash, one of the co-hosts of And My Trowel and Archaeology Book Club, the Archaeo Book Club podcast, which mm-hmm. is a newer podcast we have out on the APN.
Mm-hmm.
Her and I are going to play, well, actually, I'm going to comment while she plays because it's not a multiplayer game, so it doesn't make sense for both of us to play.
No, but you will have played, so you'll know how the game goes.
I haven't
goes.
Yet, but there's a game called C14 Dating.
Yeah.
And it's got a ridiculous title. And in fact, she found it on, like, I think she's got it on Steam. I found it on PlayStation for literally $6.
Yeah.
And because it was on sale, it was normally like $20. Ooh. And so on the 29th of November, on our Discord channel live, she's going to be playing the game. I'm going to be commenting on it, telling her where to go. And
I'm sure there'll be other folks from various different shows in there commenting, too, because it should be a fun time.
It should be a fun hang,
right?
Exactly. So go check that out. It's on you can see it promoted on Discord and in our newsletter and probably on our social media channels, if not now, coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be fun. Totally free. Nobody needs to be a member to join mm-hmm. our Discord and to go watch that. So,
and that's for our American listeners. That's the Friday right after Thanksgiving, right?
I think it's a Saturday.
Or, I'm sorry. I meant to say Saturday. Yeah. Saturday
at noon Eastern time.
Mm-hmm.
And then whatever that equates to for you.
Yep.
So, yeah, it should be entertaining. I got to bust that game out and play it at some point.
Yeah, I want to play it too. It sounds fun. We'll do it.
It's got stupid things like you're literally on an archaeology dig and it's like, what will you dig up besides artifacts and possibly a little romance or something is what it says on there.
I'm like, what is this romance piece to this game?
Like, is this about CRM archaeology?
Then also, you and I did meet on a project, so I guess
we did
romance is
romance.
A thing Yeah.
We excavated romance.
I did not excavate romance. Oh, my God.
For that shit, the back of the
car. Oh, my God. It's so ridiculous.
All right. Yeah. Well, some other people who excavated romance were some archaeologists in Germany.
Wow. That was a terrible transition. Good job.
Actually romance.
Yeah.
Unless you love Neanderthals. So.
Yeah.
Actually, it's not even Neanderthals. I was thinking we have so many articles about Neanderthals lately. This is about Homo heidelbergensis.
Yes, it is.
An extinct species of the Homo line.
Yeah.
But lived in Europe for a long time.
Yeah. So if you can't tell, we're going to do some news stories today. And this first article is called Archaeologists Found 300,000-Year-Old Human Footprints That Rewrite Part of Our Story. You know how we love a good rewriting. So, of course, we had to pick this article.
You ever want to give an archaeologist a present? Just get them an eraser.
And, you know, the other reason we picked this article is because it's from your favorite publication news source.
My favorite news source right now is Unpopular Mechanics. I don't know because I like the underdog, right. But I guess this came from their colleagues.
Popular Mechanics. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Good to know you haven't changed, even though we've been gone for a month.
Yes. I just want to know how they got so popular.
All right. What? Anyway, so the article starts by describing a set of fossilized footprints that were found in Germany. And like you already said, they are attributed to the extinct human species Homo heidelbergensis.
Yes. Yeah, they date to around 300,000 years ago, and it's in the Lower Saxony region of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the lake shore, which, you know, all good things happen on a lake shore.
Yeah. Footprints in general tend to happen on lake shores, right?
Indeed. Either lake shores or like muddy environments where there's volcanoes happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, because volcanoes can cover the mud, solidify it. Mm-hmm. Now you got footprints. That's how a lot of the ones happen down in the Laetoli Trackway.
Oh, yes. Yeah. In Africa.
In Tanzania. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So these are on a lakeshore. Lots of people come to lakeshore. Lots of people. Mm-hmm. Well, people and former people and not quite people.
And also animals, too.
And also animals.
There's just a lot of resources on a lakeshore. Of course. Of course. It makes sense, right? So it makes sense that you would find footprints belonging to all kinds of different animals and people there.
In water edges and studying past water edges, especially when it comes to rivers, lakes. Lakes tend to just either be there or go away. They can obviously grow, be huge in size, depending on where they are in relation to the ice ages.
Mm-hmm.
They can be small, but generally they're kind of in the same spot because it's water collecting in low spots.
Mm-hmm.
Rivers, though, they move all over the place because they carve into the landscape. So studying where these ancient edges were, you can generally find something there, whether it's animal remains or possibly even, you know, archaeological remains or evidence because... Well, people go there for drinking water.
Yep.
They go there for food. Animals go there for drinking water and food because there's smaller animals that are drinking and the bigger animals are like, well, you're tasty and I have water. Yeah.
Yeah.
It
attracts all of those different types of species and doing those kind of activities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these prints are the oldest known human footprints in Germany. Mm-hmm. They're calling them human footprints. I would say
it's Homo.
But they're not human.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not modern human. That's for sure.
Yeah. They're not modern human.
Yeah. These are definitely a pre-human species.
Yeah. And again, Heidelbergensis is a species that didn't continue. They died. They either died out or more likely bred out.
Yeah. There's probably a little bit of blending that happened, you know, with modern humans. But And this is 300,000 years ago. I think we already said that, but 300,000 years ago. That is a very, very long time ago. And this environment at that time, it's a lakeshore. We're talking open birch and pine forest. And like we already said, the humans and large animals would have coexisted there.
Yeah. The tracks themselves are a trio of tracks, they call it. Mm-hmm. Believed to represent a family group, including children or juveniles. So some people walking together.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. It's a trio of tracks. So there's only three individuals that they're identifying. So are there adults too, or is it just kids that were running around? That was a little unclear to me in the article.
Well, they keep calling it a family outing.
They do. Yeah.
So, which, I mean, the presence of children would sort of suggest that. I guess it really depends on how young they are.
Yeah.
I just got to say, and I know I've probably mentioned this 1,000 times before, but seeing a small group of kids where you've got maybe a young teenager and then, you know, a little adolescent, I don't know, like 8, 9 years old, and then somebody who's probably 5 or 6 years old. As a group, when I was in Africa, they were given spears and told to tend to the sheep.
Yeah.
Right. All they really had to do was herd them around and make sure they were fed throughout the day. And they were on their own on the African savannah with lions and elephants and all kinds of stuff nearby. So just saying that there were children here, they're saying it probably wasn't an adult group of hunters.
Sure.
You know, out doing something. Clearly. It was probably a family outing, they're calling it, or maybe they were just going from one place to the other. But I don't really know about that.
Well, I mean, I don't think that they would have been hurting any animals at that point. 300,000 years ago, that wasn't behavior that they were doing yet.
I'm not saying they're hurting. What I'm saying is, I don't think the kids would have necessarily been excluded from these hunting activities to learn early just because they're kids. They're little. They don't think like we do now.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, who knows? It's so hard to speculate on that because you don't have the brain of these people, so you just don't know. Right?
Yeah, but we do have the examples of other cultures in the world today, and you know, you get these like rural cultures like in Africa and things like that, and they're still living the way they've lived for many thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I just couldn't say that it's a family outing because there's kids. So
yeah.
Anyway, the article says that the human species at the site dwelt on the lake or river shores with shallow water. So they basically stayed there for a while. Like you said, good resources and the presence of plant and fungal resources like fruits, leaves, shoots, mushrooms. All around the lake is part of the setting.
Yeah. So it makes sense that they would be taking advantage of those resources there. Yeah. And they also emphasize that the human tracks are embedded among multiple animal tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And I did read, too, that, like, in some ways, they're almost a little bit more excited about the animal tracks.
Sure.
Because it represents some extinct species that we don't have a lot of evidence for. Mm. So.
Which is, incidentally, one of the ways you can date stuff like this.
Yes.
You can't date footprints.
Yeah.
But you can, if you can identify some of the other stuff, like maybe even plant remains that are crushed into the footprints and solidify with them, or the animals that are extinct, because if you know when the animal went extinct, you know, well, this must be before that.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah. And in this case, they've got extinct animals such as elephants and rhinoceroses.
Mm-hmm.
The elephant species is a Paleoloxodon antiquus. I don't know if I said that right, but let's go with it. Yeah, that's a great word, right? And it's known for straight tusks and weighing up to 13 tons. And then the rhinoceros footprints likely belonged to one of two other extinct species, either Stephanorhinus.
Nephilopagus?
Stephanorhinus kirchbergensis or Stephanorhinus hemitoecus.
Hemitoecus, yes.
Yeah, sure. Either way, extinct species of rhinoceroses.
Yes.
So, rhinoceroses, I don't know. Sure.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, finding this gives, of course, insight into the social composition of Homo heidelbergensis and their interactions with fauna. So, you know, they're family people, not family, but they're
mixed well, could group be family, of people.
Mixed group of people.
Yeah. Doing things together.
Doing things together. Eating, drinking, you know, finding food, doing things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then interacting with the landscape and the animals around.
Yep. This is what I like about footprints. Sites like this is because you get this interaction between all these different tracks, though they didn't necessarily happen at the same time, obviously, but you know, they could have, and that means that these animals and human species might have interacted together, and you get that kind of sort of put a little snapshot together of life on a lakeshore in this time frame with these different groups that may or may not have interacted, but they could have because they did exist together. So you kind of have to, like, you know, do a little bit of imagining. But that's sort of the fun part of archaeology, right? Is like just like imagining what could have been going on, what could have happened. You can't say for sure, but it's fun to just guess and think about it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to go from there and then walk one of the oldest streets in Turkey. Maybe find some mead to go with that turkey. Back in a minute.
Mead?
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 317. And now we're going to go to Turkey. And full disclosure, I've got to correct Rachel's notes because she told me to say that at the end of the last segment. There was no mead in Turkey.
I didn't say anything. I don't know if there's mead in Turkey or not. I have not done that research.
They certainly had bees. I mean, and they were possibly fermenting things.
You are king of just like throwing things out there without any like research or knowledge to back it up. So good job.
Yes. That's my academic style. Just throw shit out there and see what just sticks.
Throw it out there for the best.
Yeah.
That's our style on this podcast.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it. Anyway.
Yep.
Okay. So this article is one of the world's oldest streets unearthed in Turkey. And this comes to us from the archeonews.net website, which wouldn't normally be one that I would pick, but I actually really like this article. It's got some cool pictures in it too. So
yeah,
definitely go check it out of like the excavation and stuff.
So this is a similar settlement, but very different to one we've talked about before and one you may have heard about called Çatalhöyük.
Yes.
And that, I mean, that's probably the most famous settlement in Turkey, if not the world, really.
Because it's like one of the oldest cities in the entire world, like organized.
With this type of
big city. Yeah.
With this type of development, organization, construction, everything they had at Çatalhöyük, it makes it a unique example of something of its kind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this site is Kanhasan 3. Kanhasan 3 Höyük, and they just ended up calling it Kanhasan for basically the rest of the article.
Yeah.
But Kanhasan 3 Höyük.
Höyük means mound.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's why the Höyük is part of that. Yeah. So, yeah.
But it's in Turkey's Karaman province, and one of the earliest known streets of the Neolithic age, dating back about 9,750 years, was possibly found here.
Mm-hmm.
And this predates the settlement of Çatalhöyük by about 750 years. So,
yeah.
Could have been descendants. They were probably related in some way, and I would imagine that. Well, it does say it predates Çatalhöyük by 750 years, but
that's
it doesn't say
time.
Whether or not it was still around when Çatalhöyük was starting to be.
It does
developed.
Not mention that. Yeah.
Yeah.
We will get into this a little bit later, but there are like three distinct sites here too. There's Kanhasan 1 and 2 in addition to 3.
Yeah.
It's just that this article is about 3 specifically because archaeologists found what looks like an actual like planned passageway between some of the houses or buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And that is super rare because, well, it would be like one of the earliest examples of a street, quote unquote.
Urban planning, if you will.
Yeah, urban planning in human history. And not only that, it's like very different from the way Çatalhöyük is organized.
Yes.
So that's what makes all of this special and different and interesting.
Because people back in this time, and we know this especially at Çatalhöyük, they accessed their houses from a hole in the roof.
Yeah.
And so why would you have streets when you're just bouncing around the roofs
to
get in your house, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you just go from rooftop to rooftop. And that's kind of how it was set up.
Yeah.
Now, I do like that they're calling this, they do say in the article that, hey, this might not be a street.
Yeah.
This could be something else.
It's a space. Don't know.
I like to think that it could have just been some sort of ornery, deliberate space where somebody's like,
I don't want to hear this family anymore. They're super annoying and have 85 kids crying all day long. Yeah. So I'm putting a space here.
Let's have this little spacer.
It's entirely possible that it was like a grumpy old man space.
Grumpy old man
space. But, you know, at the same time, even if it was grumpy old man space, it still is like a different sort of urban development or urban planning.
Well,
no matter what their intentions were, you know?
And this is how innovation happens too, right? It's either happy accident or, you know, somebody does something for one reason, but the utility of the thing that happened becomes useful. So maybe, they either somebody, I don't know, accidentally or whatever, just like made this space.
Uh-huh.
And then they're like, hey, this is actually way easier than bouncing around on roofs. Let's just make more of these.
Yeah. Like, we can just like knock a door like right into this. Oh, like it could be family, right? Like maybe they were families that were close together and they just wanted a quicker way to go between their spaces rather than all the way up to the roof and across and then down again. You know, I mean, it could very well have been something as simple as that. And then it grows from there into what we call, you know, streets and sort of communal spaces that you see in cities today.
Yep.
It's really interesting. And I love these kind of, we don't know. We don't know. We're just speculating like crazy, but the speculation is so fun, right?
No.
That's my favorite part of archaeology.
Well, that's just the thing too, is we'll never know why that space was there.
No, it's like, how could you? I mean, I guess we could find like vegetation remains or animal remains or something to give us a clue, but still we'll just be guessing really for the most part. Yeah.
Personally, I think the most important aspect of this is the serendipity of doing something like that and then possibly realizing the utility of it, like I said.
Yeah.
If you don't have things like streets and spaces between your houses, why would you think of putting them there?
Right? Yeah.
Why would you think of that if you're used to just getting to them from the top? And honestly, having them all bunched up together like apartment complexes is probably safer from that standpoint.
Probably.
But that being said, how often are you being raided versus need just convenience to live?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I feel like, this would have caused. Of course, it didn't cause anything because Çatalhöyük doesn't have streets.
No, it doesn't. It does. 750 years later. So yeah. Whatever they developed here did not go with them to Tattlehook. So maybe they weren't as connected groups of people as we think. Who knows? Oh my God. Yeah, who knows? I mean, human behavior is so interesting. And
yeah,
like I said, this could have been like a protective thing for livestock. Yeah. And then maybe they just had a different way of doing it in Tattlehook. So they didn't carry that through. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. So, yeah.
Does it say in the article? I don't remember reading this, how like wide this thing is.
I don't think it did. Not in the one that we referenced anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't think it was super wide. I got the impression it was less streety and more like tunnel-y.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Another difference at this settlement were the hearths.
Yeah.
They were placed in different orientation, so to speak, than those at Chattahoochee.
Yeah, another place where this article really kind of fell down for me is I was like, how are they different? What was different?
Yeah.
I want to know those details, and we don't know what those are. They didn't say in the article, just that they were different. Yeah. But that just means that we had two distinct populations going on here, and while one might have influenced the other, the later one, but it who knows how much of an influence there actually was.
Yeah, as we mentioned before, this is Ken Hassan 3, and it's part of 1, 2, and 3, which is a complex of three different mounds. And they represent continuous human occupation from the pre-pottery Neolithic in this area up through the Bronze and Iron Ages. So quite a span of time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we know that this region has tons and tons of really old settlements. And the longevity of these three in particular is attributed to the water resources and fertile land that just would have supported large groups of people and these large settlements, animal domestication, all the stuff that we have going on here.
Yeah, some of the animal remains found at the site include those of aurochs, which I love that word.
Yeah, it's a good word.
It's basically wild cattle. Fish, waterfowl, evidence of wetland environment is nearby with rich food sources. So it's a lot of stuff. It was easy to live here from that standpoint.
And I think they're still doing research on the plant remains so that they'll probably reveal more about what was going on there as far as food, farming,
all that kind of stuff. Yeah, because farming was taking place here for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Yep.
So what are the big takeaways here? I mean, this sort of street-like space that they're calling it, it's kind of challenging that assumption that these older Neolithic settlements didn't have a lot of like planning for external spaces, communal spaces, that sort of thing. The way that Chattahoochee is laid out didn't really allot for that. This one does. So I don't know if it's challenging assumptions necessarily. It's just bringing in another option, which feels a little bit less dramatic to me. But
it's interesting to me the phrasing of a challenging assumptions about Neolithic sediments lacking planned external spaces.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not like they didn't think about it. They just, maybe they didn't need it.
Yeah.
Maybe they didn't know it. Know to do that, but
yeah, or maybe their external spaces just don't leave the kind of remains that we can find and interpret, you know, like if it was just a wide open space with nothing in it, then you're not going to find anything in the archaeological record that,
well, then,
you know, so
let's be honest too, with especially the earlier developments, you know, and building and construction methods and things like that. If you've got a bunch of structures that share walls, the minute you start breaking those up into separate settlements, you multiply the factor of construction, you know, by, you know, by whole numbers, right? So you need more construction materials. You need more stable construction materials if these are going to stand on their own. When they're all bunched together or sharing walls, then they're going to be more stable overall. And also you need less construction material.
It's true. And then you can't count out the roof piece of it, too, if roof was the access point. And it does sound like roof was the main access point for most of the structures in this settlement as well. Like that becomes a sort of communal space because the ones in the middle, you have to walk across them to get access. Right. So there's going to be some kind of communal space going on the roof. And we just might not know exactly how they were using it. So
I'm sure on a Sunday afternoon, they brought their lawn chairs up to the roof. They watched the auroch races. You know, it would have been a good time.
You know, I'll give a little teeny tiny sneak peek of something that we might be talking about soon. We're listening to a book together called A Dinner with King Tut, and we will do a review of it once we're done listening to it. But there's a whole like section of the book where I'm not sure if it's Chattahoochee or just a similar society, but it is like the roof access house is, and it's in that book. It's an interesting.
Yeah.
He does a cool like little sort of reconstruction of what life might have been like for somebody in one of those societies. So we'll talk about that more when we actually review the book. But anyway, it's just fun to speculate and think about it.
All right. Well, I think we're going to go from here and we're going to go over to Naxos, which you may remember us talking about a year ago because we were actually on the Greek island of Naxos. We spent a week there.
Yes, we did.
In an Airbnb while we were working and sort of vacationing and touring around the island and seeing things. One thing we didn't see, though, was really old Neanderthal remains. Or
we did not.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Even though they were excavating probably at the time.
Yeah, probably.
But we'll talk about it on the other side. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 317. And now we're heading over to Greece, as we mentioned, the island of Naxos. And this article is called, "A Greek Island's First Settlers Weren't Human." Clickbait.
It is clickbait, yes.
Were they aliens? In a way, they kind of were aliens to the human race. Yeah, they were Neanderthals. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
This is from newslinesmag.com, which is interesting.
I hadn't read anything from this before, but and I like this article, though, because it's a little bit more conversational than sometimes they are. So it's like trying to give, you know, life to the story behind how this the archaeology work happened. And so the article opens by describing this hillside on the Greek island of Naxos called Stelita. Mm-hmm. And for you know, we talked about Naxos and we stayed in the town of Naxos when we were there. There's the big gates of Apollo thing, which is part of the reason why we picked the island, because it just looked really cool. But if you kind of follow the coastline sort of south and west around, you get to the area that they're talking about, which is this hillside. And there's this whole story, like this sweet story about in 2014, there were archaeologists who planted flags on the land of Anne Marie de Grazia, who was recently widowed. And she and her husband had bought this land back in the 1960s. And, you know, he passed away, but his wife saw these archaeologists and they're who were like looking for Neanderthal stuff. And she's like, "Oh, cool. Go ahead. Excavate my property. My husband would have loved that." So anyway, it's a whole like cute little story.
I mean, I was thinking, did they not get permission first?
I know, it kind of
just like walking across her land.
They definitely sort of indicated that, but I thought maybe it was maybe from the street, like they were looking into things, and then she gave them full access to her property. Yeah. So really love people who get into the history of their property like that, because it just allows the history, our shared history, to be more accessible when people are generous with their land like that.
Yeah. The dig became called the Stelita Naxos Archaeological Project, and it was a multi-year endeavor to basically figure out what was going on there. Mm-hmm. And what they ended up doing was challenging previous assumptions about the early habitation of the island, because island colonization in the Aegean and all over that area, probably throughout the Mediterranean, if I had to guess, was always just assumed to be Homo sapiens, modern humans, right? Anatomically modern humans. I mean, it could have been 100,000 years ago, but still anatomically modern
humans. Who could build a boat. Because they're islands, right? So how else are you going to be accessing them?
Because those dumb Neanderthals didn't know how to do anything. That's what archaeologists always said, right?
But
I've read this. There's this article and there's two articles in the next episode that we're going to record that are also about how we're changing our assumptions about Neanderthals.
There is so much research coming out just in the last couple of years about how Neanderthals had so much more cognitive development than was previously given to them.
And we've always assumed they didn't have that much cognitive development because their brains are physically smaller. But that being said, it seems like you can do quite a bit with that.
Yeah, they had plenty going on. And they were much smaller.
And I do a lot with it.
Well, you do have a big head, though. So I don't.
But it's all bone.
I don't know what all that extra space is doing.
It's all just bone tight.
You are hard-headed.
Yes, I am.
100% true.
That's right.
Anyway.
Anyway, the finds here suggest that the habitation of the island from Neanderthals goes back over 200,000 years.
Yeah, so long ago.
Which is way longer than anybody ever thought.
And again, this is Neanderthals, not modern humans. So we're not talking about the guys that built the, you know, gates of Apollo and all that stuff. This is Neanderthal occupation.
Yeah, they built the gates of Neanderthals.
So,
But no, so one of the reasons we know it was Neanderthals is because of the types of tools that were found. Yeah. And in fact, this site was thought to be, it's an outcrop of chert, and it was thought to be what we would call a quarry site. They didn't see any habitation signs. There's very few finished products or partially finished products. It's mostly flakes. Anytime you find a place that's just mostly flakes, people, Neanderthals were like, "Listen, even we're not going to live here.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to find one of the nice caves on the coast."
It doesn't seem like it was a very hospitable island.
Yeah,
it's not today, even really. It's really not. There's not a lot of agriculture that goes on here.
There's like no Starbucks. It's crazy.
There's delicious food, though. So
and
beautiful shorelines. Yeah, they were saying that this couple that bought the land, they moved here in the 60s. not because they wanted to do anything with the land, but because they wanted the beautiful views of the coastline. So it's a tourist destination, but not necessarily one that supports people from an agricultural perspective.
Right. But there were animals. There were other things.
And there were things there.
Early inhabitants needed tools, not just to kill animals, but to process and do things with them. So the Lavoie technique that Neanderthals were known for using, basically a technique for making bifacial tools, but bigger ones, kind of like choppers and bigger tools, right?
Yeah.
That was pretty much distinctly Neanderthal throughout all of Europe.
Yeah.
And they were doing it here too.
And you need a really, really good rock source to do this. And apparently this large chert outcropping was actually visible from the sea. Yeah. So they would have known that there was probably something good there for making tools just by boating around nearby, you know, and there's tons of islands in this area. So it was probably like they might not have been living there, but they could see it. And they knew that that was a resource that they needed in order to make the tools that they need to live.
They were out on a 3-hour tour on their little Neanderthal yacht. And
Neanderthal
they're like,
yacht.
Look up there. You see what I see?
Look at that beautiful rock source. Because that's how they think about things. Is
coconuts and chert.
No.
Best chert.
Yeah.
So a 1981 survey by the French school at Athens estimated the surface finds in this area to date between 20,000 and 10,000 years ago. But of course, that's what's being pushed back here. Mm-hmm. So, and that was kind of the assumption for Naxos. That's like as early as people came because that's what they were finding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then in 2015, a team begins actual excavations and they had OSL dating run on some of their samples. And that is optically stimulated luminescence, which returned to minimum ages of 233,000 to 217,000 years ago. So that's significantly older than the 10 to 20,000 that we had before.
And they do say those are minimum ages.
Yeah.
Because that's how that dating technique works. They could be much older.
Because it's about like the light in the chart, right?
Right. Generally, it's when something is laid down, you can actually, that's how long it's been since it's been picked up.
Yeah.
Right. So it could have been older. I mean, likely at a quarry site, it's not older because somebody probably just dropped it there right after they were done doing something or whatever. But
But if you have an artifact that was clearly modified by a Neanderthal.
Oh, yeah.
And then laid on the ground and hasn't moved for 200,000 years, like then, you know, the last time it was touched by a Neanderthal was 200,000 years ago. Like there's no other option there.
Which is shocking to think of in the first place. I mean, it's not like these were necessarily surface finds, all of them. I'm sure a lot of them were buried.
Probably.
Just through time, you know, that happens.
Yeah.
But even so, the amount of time it would have taken to bury them naturally and then all the rains, not really snow. They didn't really get snow there. Maybe they did at some point in the last 230,000 years. I don't know, but definitely rain. I just can't believe in all that time, it never got flipped over.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they probably had to take a lot of samples to get ones that were in a pristine state like that, where they could actually make that judgment call. The article does note that the Aegean Sea region was once a mega island, and that sea levels and tectonics meant that passages to islands like Naxos may have involved rafts or boats, even for Neanderthals.
Yeah.
So definitely they were using water to navigate.
Yeah, for sure. And as we did mention, there are many flakes and cores indicating this is primarily a tool making location. So the flakes are what come off of the cores.
Yeah.
And the cores, some groups in the past have learned how to use cores for different things. But a lot of people really early on, a lot of people and Neanderthals and probably others, just they got down to a certain point. They're like, all right, chuck it. It's spent.
Yeah. And you might be wondering, like, why wouldn't they just take all this raw material with them back to where they live? But like, think about it. Rocks are really heavy and they're moving these things by boat probably. Yeah. So what they would probably do is find the good pieces and then knock off enough flakes to get it, you know, roughly to the shape that they would need. And by removing those flakes, they're removing a bunch of material that they don't have to carry, you know, and they're going to remove it anyway. So why take it with them? So that's sort of the utilitarian piece of this, is they would sit around, get these things shaped to the point where it was not a tool yet, but on its way to being a tool. So lighter to carry and then ready to go once they got home and knew what they wanted to turn it into.
Yeah. Having those preforms, they call it.
Yeah. Preform.
People have done that for thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah. You see that behavior because it's just logical, right? Like, why would you carry a huge like cobble when you could knock a bunch of that off and leave it behind and then not have to carry that extra weight?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So this is another point, again, where we're learning more about Neanderthals and looking at the differences between humans and Neanderthals and suggesting that there was a lot more, not only complexity between the two, but similarities between the two. Mm-hmm. And they're just, we're finding that out more and more with more sites we find, which is great.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Yep. All right. Well, I think that's probably about it for now.
Yep.
We do have another news episode planned, so hopefully we don't take a month break before we do that.
That's the plan, is to not take a month break. So that's what our plan is right
that
now.
That is indeed the plan. Yes. Oh, but I will tell you, and hopefully we record something about this. We are going to visit the archaeological site of Tulum.
Yes.
In Belize. Belize? No. In
Mexico.
Mexico. Yes. Mexico. Oh, that's right. Because it's down.
We're accessing it from Cozumel. So we're going on a cruise, taking a real vacation for the first time in a little while, in a couple weeks. And we're doing a cruise because that's what we do. And we're going to go to Tulum. We're accessing it from Cozumel.
I'm hoping to do some either live or at least recorded social stuff on our ArcPodNet Instagram page.
And we will certainly take pictures for sure.
Certainly take pictures.
They control that stuff pretty closely. Like in Chichen Itza, they had some really strong rules when we were there. So we'll see how it is in Tulum.
Yeah. My sunglasses don't.
Oh, yeah. You've got your glasses, your Meta glasses.
Yep. But anyway.
Oh, man.
We will. I would love to talk about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Because we're going to learn a lot about it. We've never been there.
Yep.
Yeah, when we were in Cancun and went over to Chichen Itza, we had an opportunity. We could have gone to Tulum because people do from there, but it was just...
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, should be fun, and hopefully we get a chance to discuss that. So.
Yep. Yeah, that'll be in a couple weeks.
With that, we are out, and we'll see you next time.
All right, bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.